Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me on the other side of this conversation is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with our most recent podcasts. We most recently talked about the Kenneth Lonergan film Margaret. Before that was The Apartment, and prior to that was Tully, the new Jason Reitman Diablo Cody picture. And I recently wrote something about what it feels like to watch Drinking Buddies 5 years later, which was a movie I liked quite a bit when it came out and still like a lot. So anyway, we'll get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Oh, I'm glad Drinking Buddies is still good.
Oh, it's so good. Okay, in like the same ways and also new ways, like it's that movie's just I remember from our podcast I was a bigger fan of it than you were, but that movie is like stone cold perfect to me. It's just so hard to watch and also so rewarding simultaneously.
Okay, well I and everyone else should read the article, but right now we're talking about a different movie.
Yes, which is also simultaneously hard to watch and extremely rewarding.
As you and I would say, and maybe other people would have a different review.
Man, I was reading some review. Okay, so we're talking about Gentlemen Broncos.
We are.
Which, all credit to you, I never would have seen without you making me watch this almost 10 years ago.
You don't think so?
Oh, I strongly, strongly doubt it. I can't.
Sam Rockwell completist?
I don't think that would have gotten me. I mean, I guess I did watch Don Verdeen, I think exclusively because Sam Rockwell and Jermaine Clement were in it. But, you know, my perception of them was colored by seeing this movie, which I will point out, you wanted to do a weed movie this week because we're Canadians and weed is now legal. I watched, well, astonishingly high, and was like physically terrified during the first scene with Bronco having his gonads removed. And just, I said to you that night, I will never watch that movie again. And I didn't for 9 years, 8 or 9 years. And I was just so happy that I did watch it again, because this movie's fantastic.
Okay, so it went through the your critical reappraisal phase.
And the rest
of the world needs to catch up.
Exactly. I mean, it's basically everybody but Richard Brody has to catch up.
Man, he was fighting the good fight.
Richard Brody's a cool character. He's a fun guy to keep up with as far as movie reviewing goes. I don't always agree with him. I think we strongly disagree with each other about like Whiplash specifically is something that I can think of, but we are on the same page with this one.
Yeah, and we kind of thought about some other things, some other weed movies to do for Legalization Week, and I just didn't know what really warranted talking about for as long as we tend to talk about movies. Mm-hmm. And while this is a movie that I guess never says drugs and drugs aren't shown,
yeah,
feels like a drug anyway. And we watched this movie and recorded this podcast while not on drugs.
Yes.
But it's a movie that, yeah, I mean, when you kind of rewatched it, really enjoyed more, and some things about it that I didn't expect you to enjoy. And this is a movie that you and I have been recommending to certain people in our lives for different amounts of times. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we'll get more into this. You and I have talked about this movie in the way that we tend to talk about movies when we do these podcasts a lot. I don't think either of us are confused about why this movie didn't make a lot of money
or why its theatrical release was all but canceled by the studio,
and even beyond that, we'll talk about that. But it's a movie that we both really enjoy, and I think movies about movies we often enjoy, and this is a movie that is you know, it has three different films within the film all being the same story. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. So it is about movies in a way, but it's about storytelling. And just doing this, deciding to do this podcast about it, I do feel like I have watched it through a different lens now.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting. So I am excited for the typical reasons to talk about Gentlemen Broncos, but excited for all the reasons that I get excited about doing even the most serious podcast that we do.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I need to talk about the cinematography right off the top, because this movie is like stunningly gorgeous to me. So I think if I was to explain, because I've done a lot of explaining this over the past few months as I've watched this movie like five or six times since June and have tried to get as many people as possible to watch it. And by that, I mean three and succeeded each time. But like how I've taken to describing it is it's kind of like Wes Anderson meets David Lynch. And with a little bit of Coen's in there. Like the cinematography is very Coen-esque and Lynchian as well.
Coen-y and their use of very bit parts and finding weird perfect people to do it.
Yeah, there's a very specific performance style, and that's very Lynchian as well. Like, and I think the level of weirdness in Gentleman Broncos really plays up the Lynch comparison. And basically, the Wes Anderson thing is the from parts of America that movies are not usually made about. This movie takes place entirely in Utah. I mean, what was the last time you saw, like, what's another movie you've seen that takes place in Utah entirely? Also just the use of lines and framing of the shots. And there's also a handful of shots from directly above books right off the top of the movie.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic sequence as well, the opening credit sequence. But I think all those things together combine to form just something that takes like all of my favorite elements of all of those movies or those styles and puts them into something that I find totally unique. Like I couldn't come up with another movie that this reminds me of, you know, and it's so bizarre. But the thing that makes it stand apart from other movies that are just like really entertaining and really funny is that there's just such a level of care in the production of this film. The production design's amazing. The cinematography is so beautiful. Like the framing is beautiful. The lighting choices are like just slightly bizarre and totally beautiful. Like there's a lot of harsh spotlighting in this movie. There's like some good halos that are very like old timey. Like the cinematography in this movie reminds me a lot of the cinematography in Phantom Thread, you know, and just the way that characters are backlit very harshly. And it just sort of makes it stand apart from reality. In ways that are just like slightly heightened, but still there's just a level of craftsmanship to the whole thing that's just very impressive. And the sound is the other key thing. Like every sound effect in this movie is just slightly louder than sound effects usually are. And some of those sound effects are so bizarre, but even the ones that aren't, the ones that are just there for to add to the naturalism of the scene, those sound effects are louder than they would be in any other movie, but only slightly. Like I remember a girl, she's talking about the name of one of her central pro tags, who is a troll mother or whatever in the classroom scene with Chevalier.
I call her Teacup in my head.
Oh, Teacup, though. Yes, that is the character's name, yeah.
She's talking about her character named Teacup, but I think of her as Teacup as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But even like when she asks her question, she's holding a pen that she picks up and puts down repeatedly every time they cut to her. But she just asks her question and then does this thing where she just fiddles with the pen a little bit before it cuts away from her. And there's just a sound to it that's just too loud, but not like overly loud, you know what I mean? And that sound combined with just adding that little movement that doesn't need to be there. In most other movies, you've already cut back to Chevalier so that Chevalier can start speaking. But just adding those little actions and adding those little sound effects to them that runs throughout this movie and I think just adds to the feel of it. And another moment I can remember is for much later in the movie where Benji's mom is going into Don Carlos's house and we just see this wide shot of her walking into the house from outside and Benji's just in the car sitting by himself. And at the very end of the shot, he goes and like scratches his ear. And it's like a type of scratching that's like so clearly was planned. Like it's a bit and they just let the shot linger. And then eventually Benji's just like, I got to scratch my ear. And it's just this tiny little thing. And it just adds to the mood and the feel of the movie and makes it just feel so totally unique.
Yeah, no, I get that. And it's odd because this movie does walk a fine line and it just sometimes I like you I sometimes have a hard time I mean, I don't have my sales pitch down for anybody I'd recommend it to, because I think I'd only recommend it to people who just would trust me on this anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
But I know what you mean. And I think that it wasn't the one that came to mind, but I think that the example of that young female writer and her pen is a good example, because this movie is so bizarre and there's so much stuff that is just absolutely bonkers. And, you know, Chevalier is not a real person, and it can't be. I'm just not going to allow that.
Yeah.
And just all the sci-fi stuff, and just some of the imagery, and even just the color palette in this movie in the real world is pretty wild.
Chevalier is inspired by somebody who's who Jared Hess worked on a film for, like a director. Like, yeah. The way he dresses and everything's entirely inspired by it, and including the Bluetooth headset that he never uses. In reading, I think probably every interview with Jared and Joshua Hess from this movie, I have learned that way more of this movie is inspired by their real life. Like, small details that you would never think were. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, it's okay, and I find that interesting too. But, you know, for all the weirdness that is in this movie, some things are so realistic, and there are some parts that, you know, you kind of get a laugh at, you know, the way Benji and his mom talk to each other, and it's obviously written for laughs, but then there's just some very real interactions throughout this movie. And, you know, the Hesses talked about pulling so much of this movie out of their life. And they were people who just moved around a lot, and, you know, all over America, and even to London. And just the way normal people would communicate in one place, you know, move a few states over, and it's kind of funny. Just, you know, there's nothing, not necessarily judgmental about it, but just all these sort of regional changes just have this inherent humor to them, just because it's you know, slightly different. And this is such a mishmash of places and times, I feel, even though it is Utah in somewhere between the invention of Bluetooth and 2009, right?
Like,
the Bluetooth is that it does give us a pretty small window of when this could be.
Yeah. The thing with Hess movies in general is that you can never really settle on a time period, you know, like Masterminds, their most recent movie. There's just, I mean, it looks like a Jared Hess movie. So there's just all of this weird, it seems like cell phones don't exist and everybody's watching CRT TVs. But then also, like, very modern technology just pops up out of nowhere. It's just like, they don't care. It's just like, it's in its own universe. And that's been true. I think Napoleon Dynamite famously, I've had so many conversations with people trying to figure out when that movie takes place.
Yeah, I mean,
because he's dressing like it's the 1980s. He's dancing to a Jamiroquai song from the late 90s. And I believe there's a cell phone that makes a brief appearance. Oh, certainly Kip using the internet. Anyway.
No, I agree. It's always the 80s, except the things that mean it's post-2000.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's a good way of putting it.
That's the way I've kind of felt about it. Yeah.
But, yeah, it does also, sorry to cut you off again, but yeah. It does sort of have the feel of the way that, like, again, I've been living in a pretty big city for the last almost 10 years now, like, so maybe my grasp on these things is weaker, but the way that technology gets adopted in a big city is not the same as the way technology gets adopted in smaller cities, where, like, one person might see, oh, a Bluetooth somewhere, and just suddenly are like, okay, Bluetooth is cool and normal. I'm going to wear that all the time. Although I guess Chevalier is the representation of big city living in this movie, but just these little things that can translate to different communities in different ways. Like how you're talking about, you know, the difference between living in Kansas and Utah is much bigger than you might think, you know?
Yeah, and not every technology necessarily saturates the market immediately.
Exactly, yeah.
A smaller town or something. just saying that there are these weirdly kind of normal things and people functioning like normal people, even though sometimes it comes off as silly or played for laughs. And for that kind of deeply normal stuff, something like that girl just kind of shaking her pen, and then, you know, that's a normal thing to do. I can see people in a classroom doing that, or, you know, kind of nervous to talk to someone who they look up to or someone who's an authority figure. Or that's just a little tick that she has, right? And there's no need for it in the movie, other like, or in any other movie kind of trying to tell this story. And as you said, they have the sound effect of her doing it and they amplify it. And so it is this kind of very amplified banality is what so much of this movie is. It's it's playing up this small kind of quiet existence. But then sometimes hammering you over the head with how small it is. I mean, just watching it this time, the first real line of dialogue is something like, "I've heated up the hot water bottle so you can sit on it."
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's not really a joke, but it, you know, it gets a laugh. And that's not an insane thing to someone to say to someone. And I wouldn't be shocked if at one point, you know, one of our parents said that to one of us, you know, like, I don't know that to be true, but it still gets a laugh. And there's something about the way that this movie sets up some of these small things to be so much funnier than they are, and the way that it amplifies these small kind of normal things and puts them under a microscope for you to get a bit more humor out of, but then also is just absolutely bizarre and insane in these totally fantastical, spectacular ways that aren't about how mundane, you know, a road trip with your mom to a bus stop can be.
Yeah.
And then and then there's purple vomit taking down a battle stag. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's the way that it makes such a big deal of some of this tiny stuff, but also has this arsenal of explosive, brightly colored action.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I like amplified banality. That's a good way to describe a lot of the highlights of this movie.
Yeah. And yeah, just reading about this, watching it the last time, I did just find taking notes on small things that I knew I wouldn't like. Maybe part of me was hoping that it would coalesce to some grander meta point, but it's just things that like, why does Danius have oral herpes when he's talking to him for the first time? Like, there's just all these things that I felt compelled to kind of note just because they are so interesting. And I think, I mean, I guess what it was is that I was trying to place where this movie gets its vibe from, and it's so tough, and I'm just trying to pick out a couple of things of the most mundane but the most extreme that kind of get you in this place where I don't know, it's not uneasiness, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure plenty of people are uneasy.
It's definitely uneasiness at times.
At times, for sure. But just trying to pinpoint the vibe of this and kind of, you know, what kind of hang this is. And I think that Wes Anderson plus David Lynch plus a bit of Coens is a pretty apt one. And I don't think I would have been able to come up with it, but I like it.
Yeah. That has been workshopped over the past many months. I did like initially the first one that came to mind for me was Wes Anderson. First time I watched it again and got all excited and was like blowing you up by a text message about it. but yeah, it's like, I don't know why it took me so long to get Lynch in there as my head, because it's so obviously Lynchian, and I'm also a big David Lynch fan. It just seems so, David Lynch seems so like in his own cinematic world, which is weird to say when you're comparing somebody to Wes Anderson, who also clearly has his own cinematic world, but it's not as like the line isn't as harshly drawn as the one that Lynch has drawn over the years. But I do think that the comparison works.
Yeah, well, and I think that despite obvious moments of just kind of gross out stuff and cringy stuff, that even people who watched this movie and hated it say this was a comedy that didn't work. And Lynch is often so serious. And I mean, don't get me wrong, what I have seen of Lynch, he has some absolute high points of very weird hilarity, but
yeah,
obviously intended hilarity nonetheless. But
yeah, just he's a very funny filmmaker.
Yeah, I just think when you think broadly about David Lynch, you think of serious and dark and gross.
Yes,
and
I agree. Just
very heavy. So I can see why it takes a bit longer to get there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, okay. I mean, how do we even talk about like Sam Rockwell and Jermaine Clement on this? I guess we got to do it separately. But like, I don't really have much to say about them other than like, these are two of my favorite comedic performances ever, you know, like it's
right. And
especially Jermaine is just, I'm on record saying I think Jermaine is one of the funniest human beings who's ever been alive. Like, just he can just say a line in a way that will just make me laugh regardless of what he's saying, you know? And I feel like if like anybody ever had to be tasked with this very bizarre and something that might happen in a Jared Hess movie, you have to be told that your mother is dead, but you also have to be told in a way that's going to make you laugh immediately. I feel like Jermaine Clement should be the nomination to take that job. But like, there's just something so deeply funny about him and so unique about his performance style. But also it's just impossible to describe a performance in any way other than just to say, like, to talk about how good it is other than just to say, just watch the performance, you know? I mean, it's like when we did our podcast on Tully and it took us about an hour before Charlize Theron came up, despite the fact that she's fantastic in that movie. Yeah. It's just so self-evident sometimes.
Yeah, so with Jermaine. Yeah, I think he is so funny in this. It never stops being funny. And in all the negative reviews I read, people really have a hard time not putting the asterisks next to this performance and saying, this is undeniably fun and funny, and why wasn't there more of this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Because even though the humor does fit in with this movie, you know, it's not like this is shoehorned in and doesn't fit the rest of the tone of this movie, because I think it does, but you could plug him into pretty much any comedy in the last 20 years and with maybe minor tweaks, but probably none, this character with this guy playing him would just make people laugh. Like, yes. I just think that, as you said, you kind of just have to see it, but there is something so just weird and undeniably funny about this. And it is nice that how often quiet this movie is, and, you know, his weird kind of solo scene, which, I mean, his scene when he's teaching, I think, has to be his best stuff, despite other things being good.
I would make an argument for the scene where he's, like, the Q&A that gets advertised to Benji by, like, a piece of mail in an envelope that's just saying Q&A this Saturday or whatever. Yeah. I think, like, there's just the way that he says a few of those lines is just so funny. Like, the writing is funnier in the classroom scene that you're describing. Yeah. Like, what is said is funnier in that scene, but how it's said is funnier in the scene that I'm describing, and like more distinctly Jermaine to me, which I think is what makes it my favorite. Anyway, sorry.
That scene is kind of, I mean, there are musical bumpers kind of throughout this movie of some jaunty guitar. Mm-hmm.
I do like the score on this movie a lot.
Yeah, it is good. And it's kind of a bit might be some of the Wes Anderson infusion, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of it's David Wingo that does the score for this movie. And he does all of Jeff Nichols. And he also does David Gordon Green stuff, which is like people that, I mean, the last movie made about Utah was probably a David Gordon Green movie, you know, like just people that make movies in this same different region. But yeah, anyway, just because I felt like bringing up the score at some point.
Yeah, you know, you're right, too. But there are these kind of bits of, I guess, interstitial music. But sometimes this movie goes without that, and, you know, or just opens with Chevalier and some weird like karate flute noise to kind of set the tone for who this guy thinks he is. But I do love that just so many of these scenes can be so different from each other. And because people kind of call it meandering and scattershot, and I get why that vibe comes off. But there is something about the aimlessness of this movie that it successfully fails to not set you up for what you're about to get into in any, you know, whatever the next scene is.
Yeah.
And I think that works so wonderfully in this movie that does give you so many different and weird and fun things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know. We could talk about Jermaine forever. You want to move to Sam Rockwell?
I think so.
One last thing about him. Is just as we talked about them, kind of the Hesses pulling the story of every different place they live, and this being, you know, we've talked about three different directors, like Lynch to Wes Anderson. I could draw you the Venn diagram where things overlap with them. You know, they do have some of the same interests, yeah. I would say, mm-hmm. But they're very different people. So I think that they do a good job of pulling these different things and different styles and intentionally or not, I think it's summed up well. Chevalier, who's, I guess, fake British, but dresses in New Mexican dad wear. Like, it's all a very pretty wild combination of things that seems to work for him.
Yeah, and his vocal inspiration was Michael York in Logan's Run, which if you watch a minute and a half of Logan's Run, you will die laughing if you have seen Gentleman Broncos.
And that it's, you know, he's kind of got this, you know, like a lot of earth tones and materials, like the leather and stuff, but also a Bluetooth, and, you know, constantly talking about sci-fi, and he's just this wonderfully diverse result of a bunch of different influences.
Yeah, for sure. And so Sam Rockwell, basically the same thing, just with different specific examples, you know, like just one of a kind performer that we're both deeply in the tank for. And yeah, he's hilarious.
Yeah, and I'd say I think we are in the tank for those people for different reasons. I mean, the broad reason being that they're good at what they do, but for the most part, they can bring different things to the table. Mm-hmm. I guess we just haven't seen Jermaine's dramatic side or his dancing. but we just know Sam Rockwell can do a lot of things, and obviously he didn't have an Oscar then, and he's not quite the same person, but he didn't need to do this to get more work. I just love that he did this. And I loved Sam Rockwell before this. I loved that he did this. I love him in this. I love him. Like, I've loved him for things that he's done after this. And it just makes me so happy that he ended up in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Sam Rockwell's career, he's never chosen movies because he feels like it's a good career decision. He's chosen them because he's wanted to either work with the person that's making the movie, the people that are making the movie, or because he just thought that the role might be fun. Like, there are not a lot of, like, proper Hollywood movies that you can find Sam Rockwell in. You know, he's just, like, that's just not the career that he has.
Yeah.
Or that he's desired, you know.
Right. And I mean, so what do you think compels him for this? I don't know if you ever come.
Oh, he just wanted to have fun. That's what it was. Like, and I that's a lot of the time that is what leads him to pick a role, is that it just seems like he could get to do something fun and a little, in this case, a little bit bizarre. He just sort of, he gets to do a different kind of dance, you know. It's a very physical performance from in his standpoint. But
he does look like he's having fun.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. And also from interviews that I've read, it sounds like the possibility of playing both Bronco and Brutus was very appealing to him. And it wasn't always going to be that the same person was going to play Bronco and Brutus, but Sam Rockwell was like, no, I want to play them both. And when Sam Rockwell says, I want to play two characters in your movie, you get double lucky as opposed to one, a single lucky. You know?
Yeah, that's true. What do you make of the different interpretations of the story? I mean, we talked about how this is a film within a film, but it's, you know, it's that at three different times as we watch. I mean, I guess one of them's a book or one and a half of them, but Benji's version of the story, Chevalier's version of the story, and Lonnie, who we have failed to mention thus far as well, and Tabitha, who both of them do some great work. So
they are both fantastic. I think Tabitha is so, I mean, she's the closest to a straight man that this movie has, and she's so, so good in this movie. I mean, I guess Benji's kind of the straight man, but anyway, sorry.
No, I think that's kind of true, though, and I don't know. Do you see that as a failure of this movie, or?
I think the, I mean, there are a couple things. There are like two things I don't think work about this movie, and pretty much everything else is fantastic. I don't think the movie sticks the landing. I think the fashion show. In my heart of hearts, I feel like the movie should have ended with the song 2525 Still Going, which is the same song from the opening credits that ties up all of Benji's story. And then we get the fashion show with Benji's mom, which is a nice like touch to end the movie on, because she helped him so much. It's good to help her. It's just, there's just something about it that doesn't land to me. Like, I feel like maybe there was a way to rework that, that could have ended in just a more triumphant way. It feels like it ends very triumphantly, and then there's one more short scene, you know? And that last battle that Bronco's in is just, like, really well done and really puts a good bow on the movie. And I know it doesn't tie up everything in Benji's story, so I understand the reason of coming back, back out of fantasy. But there's just something about it that maybe it doesn't happen quickly enough, or... I don't know. And just when the credits pop up on screen, it's just like, oh, I mean, I guess this is the end now, you know, like, there's just something about it that doesn't work. And also, the Tabitha Benji sort of whatever their friendship relationship is, there's no wrap up to that. And it just is just, it's just empty. There's just nothing to it. And I'm fine with, like, not totally understanding Tabitha's motivations throughout the movie. Pretty much the entirety of the movie, she's just kind of all over the place. But I feel like you kind of need an ending there, and there just isn't one.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And yeah. So, but you think that the resolution of his mother's story, that's more of an editing problem, right? Like, they just don't manage to put that together.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And like, the thing is, I don't have a solution for how it could be solved. You know, like, sometimes I see a movie, and I'm like, oh, I feel like the Jason Bourne is a good example where I felt like I could make the movie stronger by cutting out 5 minutes or whatever. So that's what I did. And I feel like I did it right. I feel like it works. You know, there's still some stuff in it that I hate. Like him jumping off the roof for no fucking reason. And, but like, some of that stuff's just totally unavoidable because it's in the writing, and it was just a bad choice in the writing. I don't feel that way about General Broncos necessarily, but they just don't stick the landing. But I don't have any, like, concrete ways that could have been solved, because I don't think this movie could end in the fantasy realm. I don't feel like that would be satisfying if it had just ended on Bronco's story, because I think that sends a different message from what the rest of the movie does. The movie's not about escaping reality. It's about creating a new reality to augment your own and make your life more fulfilling. So I understand why they're, again, trying to make another life more fulfilling. It just doesn't work. Yeah. It feels like it's ending just on a, like, regular ass exhale instead of, like, pumping your fist in the air as the previous scene ends, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I know what you mean by that. And I was just thinking about, you know, when I asked about the editing thing, I didn't necessarily need to, like, a solution to it. I was just wondering, you think that, like, just, it's been a while since we've kind of talked about a movie that we didn't kind of get to the crux of the story out early, and I don't think we've talked a ton about the narrative of this movie. And I think it is a lot of fun, and it's funny, and as I said, it kind of has a plot that is more meandering, and this your interest in this movie doesn't come from the plot mechanics and necessarily, like, what happens next in a traditional sense, just because it is, you know, an odder combination of scenes sometimes, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think there's a very interesting through line throughout this movie, but you are correct in that when I was all excited about having just watched it and telling people about it, it's not like I was like, you got to see this plot, the way that scene A connects to scene B is crazy, you know? Yeah, you are right. Those are not the things that jump out, but I do think there's a thoughtful idea running throughout this movie that is expanded upon throughout the story that really works.
Yeah, and I did want to get to that, as I said, just kind of watching this movie, knowing all of the weirder things and sort of being able to you know, not that I wasn't enjoying them, but put them off to the side and try to look at this the way that we would watch most movies that we talk about. Just, I mean, just as a log line, it's sort of a movie about a poor young author who's still grieving the death of his father, who kind of gets disillusioned by the film industry or his hero, you know, that sounds like a serious movie.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so to go back to what you originally asked about in the three different perceptions of this story, is that, you know, we've got the novella, which Benji writes by himself and then sells it to Lonnie, who then sort of turns it into his own his own film that he's directed. Like, anytime somebody sells a script to a director, if that person is an Aaron Sorkin, then the director takes more control of your story than you have. And then Chevalier just full on steals Benji's idea. So we've got sort of the somebody writing from the sort of pure place of imagination, and he does want it to get published, but the yeast lords,
yeasty boys.
Yeah, it's just so many things in this movie are just fun to say. Yeast lords is great. The title Gentlemen Broncos is fantastic.
We could put a pin in that, but do you know where that comes from?
I do. I have a quote for you if you want me to read it to you.
No, I think I have the same one, but please, I'm sure anyone who's listened this much would like to hear.
Yeah, so this is Jared Hess talking about, somebody asks him about the title. My mom had a parenting book written in the 50s called So You Want to Raise a Boy? There was a chapter in there where the author referred to the 16-year-old stage in a young man's life. He called it the gentleman bronco phase of life, where young men like to take their shirts off and mow the lawn. It didn't make much sense, but I really like the title.
Which I think is wonderful and so appropriate for this movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, lightly touches on the slightly sexual nature of this movie.
Yes.
Which to extremely sexual nature of this movie at times. So yeah, I mean, wonderful story is kind of an aside, but it does kind of get me to Jared's relationship with his mother and Benji's relationship to his mother. And, you know, as we were saying, kind of the more important plot points or synopsis reading of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we've got the Benji's version, which is a novella that he writes by hand, at, sort of totally on his own, gives it to Lonnie, and then Lonnie makes his interpretation, which I think there's an honor in that, but I think the movie sort of doesn't necessarily vilify him, but sort of like paints Lonnie in a certain way eventually, in that Lonnie basically pays for, he doesn't really pay for it. He sort of fake pays for the script and then makes his own version. He's still being creative, and which is why I don't think the movie vilifies Lonnie. He's still got this sort of youthful creativity and is actively working really hard to make something. It's just not what Benji had written necessarily. It's not the way that Benji saw it in his head.
But there's no kind of promise that things are going to stay the same, right? You know, we don't see Lonnie as, you know, he does treats him kind of rudely, definitely at times, but you don't see him as the same kind of, with the same deviousness of Chevalier.
Yeah, exactly. And the way that the movie kind of vilifies Lonnie is towards the end, the premiere of Yeast Lords, where he's like actively courting the press and actively cares about the reception of the movie. And I think the idea with Benji is that he's doing it purely for himself or for his own interior reasons, and Lonnie cares more about external forces, whereas Chevalier is all external forces. You know, like he talks a lot about the book covers, like that seems to be the thing he cares more about than the actual story itself. But like, he takes the story and just turns it into something that he feels like can help making more money. And I think throughout the movie, the contrast between Benji and Chevalier is just constantly the contrast between having money and not having money, the doing things for other people or doing things for yourself. Benji and his mom really represent the entrepreneurial spirit, whereas somebody like Chevalier is just like a rich person to a T, you know? Like I said, Benji handwrites his story. Chevalier uses a computer. The Bluetooth thing he never uses, like just the way that Chevalier is framed with technology. There's not a lot of technology with other characters in this movie. And there's a lot of wood in the production design behind characters and around characters, especially in Benji's house. And I think that there's sort of like a naturalism aspect to Benji that we're supposed to sort of take as more pure, you know, like less zeros and ones like Chevalier is dealing with, you know. And even just the idea of every time Chevalier talks about something he's written, he talks about it in trilogies, you know. It's like he's making things almost in bulk because he can make more money if you make three books, whereas what Benji writes, Yeast Lords, is a novella, you know. Like, it's not even a novel, it's a novella. And I think,
and when you go through his books at the end too, they're not sequels and stuff either.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's it's stuff like that that I think really does a good job of contrasting those two characters and adding some ideas to the movie. And I mean, at the core of this movie is Benji learning or trying to, and then learning the importance of basically holding on to things as they were in his brain, right? Like, he wants to keep them exactly how he saw them in his imagination. And he does eventually become a success. Like, he sells his book. Even if nobody buys the book, he at least probably got money for the publication of it, you know?
Yeah.
Or definitely did, because you could put on a fashion
show.
Yeah, exactly. But even if you go to the story of Yeast Lords, Yeast Lords is about a reproductive organ being taken from a Bronco, who is specifically like designed after Benji's dad, you know? So it's a reproductive organ, and it's something that's like a part of him, a very important part of his body if he wants to produce something again, in this case, yeah. a person. And it's just to make an army of lookalikes, which is what Brutus becomes. And it just sort of is, this is a movie about Chevalier sort of taking the metaphorical nad of Benji. And Benji's just like, Benji doesn't know if he can create anymore because he's been so disillusioned. And eventually things work out for him. But I think it's the contrast between Chevalier and Benji is really cool. And also the way that Yeast Lords tells that story in a very abstract way is also fantastic. You know,
we have Tabitha spelling out about like some of that stuff in Yeast Lords.
Related
to Benji's own life with his father. But they don't really, I mean, they spell out that half, but they don't, I think, dig into the, obviously, the other stuff about Benji's creative side as much. That's not really as spelt out.
Yeah, and Benji's mom, right, in the first, like, 3 minutes of the movie says, I guess maybe for 5 minutes of the movie, when she's dropping him off at the bus, never forget who you are or what you came from or whatever. You know, like, that's what the movie is about. Like, they just say the thesis of the movie, but she says it in a funny enough way. She almost does the hang loose sign. And just, like, all of those, that combined with the fact that... you know, these are kind of literal descriptions of both with Benji's mom and Tabitha's scene that you're discussing in the hotel. They're like explaining to the audience what the movie's about, but there's so much nonsense throughout the movie that you can't tell when somebody is literally talking to the audience. And I think that's where in a more conventional movie where somebody explaining something to the audience makes certainly like infuriates me, and definitely in most cases bothers you as well. It's just the constant abstraction of this movie that you don't realize when you're being spoken to, you know? And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And, to say something more about Benji and, Chevalier, we see Benji writing, you know, that's his work, but he also has this very, you know, I don't know, quite blue collar, but you know, a just a job at the mall, it seems, selling, working with his mother, I guess. And Chevalier's work that we see him do is press or painting. And once again, you know, just this idea of the image and just a book cover, you know, they say, don't judge something by its cover. Don't judge a book by its cover. But Chevalier is just all surface, and that's kind of what he has. You know, he's taken that bad piece of advice and ignored it and put much more focus on just the image of a book than the contents of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that's very subtle in this movie that's worth pointing out, and I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts on it. Like, I mean, it's just a small point, but I found that there's some artwork and some clothing choices of what Chevalier wears throughout the movie where he's wearing sort of... indigenous inspired clothing, or there's that skull, or sorry, that piece of artwork in his home right next to where he's writing that's clearly indigenous inspired if not artwork itself, you know. And and I think that's a really interesting subtle way to show like somebody taking what's not theirs, you know, without ever really drawing attention to it. It's like, it's the history of the country, and and to sort of pair that with Chevalier without ever drawing attention to it, I think it's really cool. And and I did look for it with Benji and couldn't find anything similar for any other character, and it just sort of seems to be paired with Chevalier, and I thought that was a really, really nice choice. A very small choice, but a nice choice.
Yeah, and I think in Kansas and Utah.
Yeah.
You know, that's the West. That was the frontier at a point, so that would line up.
Yeah, not that this movie is, like, hella woke or anything. It does get overtly transphobic at the very end. But, I don't know. I just thought that was a nice touch. And also, 2009, 2010, it's, like, shocking how many, like, there's this movie, it's always, it's kind of a funny story, which is directed by Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, who did Sugar, which is a movie we've podcasted about, which is one of the most empathetic movies that's ever been made. It's kind of a funny story. It's, like, years and years ahead of its time as far as its depiction of mental health and stuff like that. And then just out of nowhere, a kid just drops a transphobic joke. And then Lauren Graham, who's playing that kid's mom, just looks at the kid and then looks up and repeats the joke. And it's just like, it's baffling that it can come in such an empathetic movie. And I think the same is true of that line towards the end of Gentlemen Broncos. But I also do think we probably didn't bat an eye at it in 2010, you know? Yeah. It's just, I don't know, things have changed in a good way on that front, I suppose. But I don't know. I always feel like we need to point out certain things in history that have changed in films, because we can't only talk about the good things in this movie and the things that make us laugh. We've got to talk about the things that make us go, oh, you can't say that anymore. You know,
yes,
you yeah. probably shouldn't have ever said that. But,
yeah. Yeah, fair.
Yeah. Because also, I mean, the previous movie by the Hesses was Nacho Libre, featuring Jack Black playing a Mexican character. Which I remember seeing in 2006 and being like, yo, this is racist.
And it's 2006.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I felt those needed to be mentioned. I don't know. I don't feel like I have a lot more to add about this movie. I just think this movie is like, it's certainly not perfect, but the level of care in this production is just astonishing for a movie that is so underseen, like so deeply underseen. The studio that Fox Searchlight, the studio that produced it, was like, oh, this is the movie you made? Get it away from us. Put it on DVD. And then have one person in Toronto buy a copy and then and then luckily show it to his roommate. But all of those things, that I just think that it's really interesting that the story of this movie itself, like the story of the actual movie, ties into, you know, the I don't want to say botched, there's no version of this world where this movie is a financial success. I just refuse to believe it. It just yeah. couldn't possibly have happened. But I think, I feel like the Hesses must be incredibly proud of this movie, because as somebody that's seen all of their movies, it's far and away their best movie. It's so totally unique in a way that I say about very few movies. And it really does feel like a movie where they really held on to 100% of what they wanted to do, and somehow were able to win enough arguments that they got to make the movie that they wanted to make. And the cost was not everybody saw it, or not a lot of people saw it, but they somehow made this movie that, like, 10 years from now, I mean, when I first saw it, which was less than a year after it was released, when we watched it together, I mean, we were already saying, how did this get made, you know? And I saw Bad Times at the El Royale earlier this week, which, again, not a perfect movie, but I know that years from now, I'll be like, how did a studio fund this? And I always think that's, like, a really impressive thing to be able to pull off, is that you're going into this unbelievable sort of woods that nobody really understands. And the people that make films are so far removed from the type of people that finance films, especially now that studio heads are run by, like, former CEOs of Six Flags. And it's just such a difficult thing to be able to pull off a vision that feels distinctly your own, and to pull off a vision this bizarre and this distinctly their own with money from Rupert Murdoch, you know, like, I just think that's really, it's impressive, and it's commendable, and this movie's fantastic. And if the cost is changing this movie to get more people to see it, I'm glad they didn't change this movie, because this movie, like, this movie will full on go out of print in our lifetime. Like, this movie will be lost to history, and you and I will be like 82 drinking whiskey on a porch somewhere and be like, remember Jermaine Clement and Gentlemen Broncos? One of us won't remember, and we won't be able to find evidence of the performance. And like, if that's the cost of the amount of love I feel for this movie now, then so be it, you know? Like, it's so distinctly unique, and there are not a lot of movies like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks for listening to The Guffman, and be sure to check back next time.